I mean, really what I'm trying to get to is the great replacement theory. You know, we're talking about this sort of shift in the media now where we're actually discussing this subject of like, what is the great replacement theory? Who are the great propagators of this idea? And like one example, of course, is Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson being the most popular pundit on television, having one of the most popular and most watched TV shows consistently in the United States on Fox News. And you look at the clips, or you look at, you know, you just watch one of his shows, not that I've seen one from beginning to end because I can't stomach it. But I think if you've, you know, been following, of course you have, and I'm going to ask you about this, Tucker Carlson, being the most popular voice in the United States right now, he is most definitely, in his rhetoric, how he's speaking, couching white nationalist ideas and the Great Replacement Theory, and he's presenting it to his audience. And I really want to ask about this because he's being targeted now. I mean, they're like, he's getting, when I say targeted, there's like a real focus on him now, being like, look, like the way you're talking about this is connected to directly to what's being written about in these manifestos of these white supremacist shooters. Of course, he denies that, but if you could talk about like Tucker Carlson's role in this sort of drift that we're, you know, experiencing right now to the far right, to fascism. Yeah.
I mean, he's been doing it a long time. There's that the New York Times did that big investigation of him that dropped in April that everyone should definitely read. You know, and if you don't have the Times, just use a incognito browser to read it. Yeah. And you know, like all the browsers have an incognito or anonymous mode where you can read a few articles for free. And, you know, so, but to get back to your point about like, you know, so the strategy is to deny, deflect, and lie, right? And so for a long time, it was like, oh, it's, they're lone wolves. And it's just like, well, you know, how many lone wolves does it take to make a wolf pack? You know, there have been so many of these killers who basically are very explicitly endorsing great replacement theory. You know, Peyton Gendron, the Buffalo shooter who massacred 10 African Americans, he repeatedly cites a great replacement theory in his manifesto. Patrick Crucius also talked about a replacement. Dylan Roof, I can't remember exactly if he used the term, but it was essentially what he was talking about. Brenton Tarrant in New Zealand was doing it as well. But you get plenty of others who they may not use the term, but that is exactly what is motivating them, right? And great replacement, for folks who don't know, it was the term itself was coined by this like far right Frenchman who actually used to be a socialist, Renaud Camus, and he wrote a series of books, including one in 2011 called The Great Replacement, and it's the idea, and it's thoroughly anti-Semitic, that elites and globalists are, you know, code word for Jews, are conspiring to replace white people, white European culture, with these dirty, brown, subhuman peoples, immigrants, Muslims, Africans. Yeah. And obviously, in the U.S., it takes a bit of a different turn. But you have so many of these killers, like, you know, they're ones like what was his name? Alexander Bissonnette. He's the Quebec City. He killed six Muslims after Trump's Muslim ban was announced because he was angry that Justin Trudeau announced that they were going to let in 25,000 Muslims. Bissonnette was a Trump fan, and so he went into a mosque and slaughtered six Muslims. There was a guy, was it Adam Purrington? Again, right after Trump got into office, he attacked This is in Kansas. Olathe, I think, was a state. He attacked two South Asian engineers, Indian engineers, yelling at them, get out of my country, killed one of them and bragged afterwards that he had killed an Iranian. You know, he couldn't even, he thought they were from Iran. And of course, Trump was used that. Okay. The kind of the vicious anti-Iranian sentiment, you know, the kind of consistently the most hated community that in terms of Trump directs a lot of just complete like vicious rhetoric and also targets is the Somali community, right? Because they're immigrants, they're Muslims, they're Black, they're African, and also, congresswoman from Minneapolis. Oh my God, I can't believe I'm blanking on
Ilhan
her name.
Is it Ilhan Omar?
Ilhan Omar. She's you know, a very prominent Somali American, very progressive, a refugee herself. There was an incident even before the 2016 election, where there was these three guys who called themselves the Crusaders, where I think this was in Wichita, were planning to wipe out an entire complex of Somali immigrants. And they were actually going to wait to do it after the election because they didn't want to do anything to hurt Trump's electoral prospects. Yeah. But they assumed he was going to lose. And there are all sorts of other incidents. You know, the latest piece I did for the Raw story about the replacement killers, you know, how Trump and Tucker spawned a new breed of terrorism. I start out with this one killer that virtually no one remembers by the name of Keith Luke. He went on a rampage the day after Barack Obama, the first Black right. president, was inaugurated. And he developed, you know, and it sounds exact, you know, it's just like when you look at the details of the case, he sounds exactly like Peyton Gendron, you know, this basically a former troubled high school student, a loner, got radicalized on the internet. You know, he surfing white nationalist websites. He hatched this plan over months. And what he decided was he was going to kill as many non-whites as possible. And he also blamed the Jews. Like, you know, it's easy enough to Google up these manifestos, and Peyton Gendron has a lengthy section on Jews and that they're the real problem. But, you know, he's like, we have to act now. And so that's why he chooses to go after this Black people in this supermarket.
Yeah. You know, there's several threads I want to... This always happens at this point in the interview where I'm like, man, there's so many different directions to go in. But there's this. Okay, I'm trying to figure out how to articulate this. I remember in the first interview we did, you talked about we could effectively call them pogroms in the U.S. where there were massacres throughout the, say, the 20s. Just take the 20th century. Right. Massacres.
Right. State supported massacres. The Texas Rangers began as a death squad. Again, right. Google it. Look it up. There's been a lot of scholarship done in the last 20, 30 years. Thousands of brown people, they massacred along the border.
Right. There is this quality of just whiteness itself, which is it's so like you talk about the body and you're thinking about that sort of visceral, like there's this thing that happens when, like you said, even if it is a symbolic thing, a Black man is a president of the United States, that is so deeply upsetting to a rather large subset of the U.S. population and elsewhere. You mentioned in Montreal, so this isn't just the United States, but in the U.S. and Canada and elsewhere, there's something just so... It's so repellent to, again, a very large subset of the white population that the inclination is to massacre groups of people that are viewed as subhuman. There's just like this deep characteristic of whiteness that is so murderous. It's like, it's, I know this is an obvious thing to state, but it's just like when we have these things happen over and over, and it happens in different forms in different ways. I do not see what happened in Buffalo or any of these other places as being any different from lynchings that happened 100 years ago or less, 50 years ago, whatever. It's like there's a pattern and it's being followed. And I think as white identity feels threatened in some form, however, it just this sort of violent these violent outbursts start happening. It's like the body is fighting, it perceives itself as fighting a disease. And I just had to comment on that. I don't know what you had to contribute to that. I just really wanted to, like, that's what comes up in my mind when you say all these things.
Well, you know, we go back to when Trump began his campaign, you know, that Mexico is not sending their best. They are rapists, they're criminals, they're drug dealers. And at one point early on, he went on about how they're, you know, poisoning our youth. And the previous year in 2015, I went to, this was for investigative report, I went undercover to the conference of a National Sheriff's Association, and it was just utterly fascinating. I could have, I was writing about these things known as jail debit cards, another way to rip off the poor. You take their money, right, and you give them a debit card with fee instead of giving their money back when they get out of jail. Mm. So in any case, I went to all these different panels, and it's just like everyone, I could have written a fascinating article. And one of them was about, and you had like top level, like U.S. officials, like, you know, kind of like undersecretaries from DHS who show up and talk to sheriffs from around the U.S. And this one panel on the border crisis, you know, because it was, I think it was in 2014 where, you know, there was that huge surge of migrants from Central America, thanks in large part to Hillary Clinton supporting the coup in Honduras that, you know, led to this kind of like death squad government and, you know, completely like destabilized the country even more. Ended up at one point, I mean, it was astonishing that, like, I looked at the data, like, it was a few percent. I think it might have been like 1 year, like close to 10% of Hondurans were like recorded coming into the U.S. I mean, it was absolutely astonishing numbers. Maybe not 10%, but it was it was like a massive amount were fleeing the country. And so these DHS officials were talking about, they went into every single border community to do a town hall. And remember, they are I'm in this conference room with all these like sheriffs, you know, and sheriff's deputies in there. And the DHS officials were saying, you know, we got the same three questions everywhere we went. Are they bringing in crime? Are they terrorists? Are they bringing in disease? And even then I was like, wow. Yeah. You know, it's just like, okay, that is like pretty, you know, it's all about the idea that the body is being corrupted. And the way this relates to fascism is this kind of like cross-class project of a national renewal, right? And it's about like reaching back to the past as a program for the future. That's why MAGA has this fascistic quality to it. It's not necessarily fascist. You know, Trump got stole that from Ronald Reagan. You know, Ronald Reagan is the one who used MAGA, Make America Great Again, in his 1980 campaign. Mm-hmm. But it's about, you know, this notion of reaching back to the past and this idea that there was this kind of like unspoiled pure community, right? Corruption and purity. And these immigrants are bringing in disease, they're bringing in crime, they're bringing in drugs. This is a poison. And it's all kind of like it's laying the groundwork for the idea of great replacement. And great replacement, it's a very simple idea, right? The idea that white people are being replaced by these, you know, unwashed subhuman hordes. And it goes far back in U.S. history. There's a viciously racist anti-Semitic lawyer figure on the right who was in elite circles, Madison Grant, who wrote this book about the passing of the great race, where he called the Nordics the great race, the master race, and that they needed to be protected against these subhuman peoples who had to be eliminated or deported. There's a famous Jim Crow senator, Democratic senator from Mississippi, Theodore Bilbo, who in the early part of the 20th century also espoused very vicious great replacement ideas. I'm trying to remember who the neo-Nazi who came up, was it David Lane with the concept of white genocide? Mm-hmm. And he's also, I believe he was the one who coined the 14 words, which Peyton Gendron explicitly uses in his manifesto. We must secure an existence for our people, or we must secure an existence for white people and a future for our children, right? That is kind of the great replacement, white genocide in a slogan. And so, and actually it's even just, how 1312 has become this kind of Antifa, all cops are bastards. Yeah. 1488 is this fascist. So 14 words and 88, which is HH or Heil Hitler. So it's a great replacement is a very simple concept to understand. And so it's been around a long time, even if it hasn't used that terminology. And that's why, I've been covering these killings for a long time now. And that's why when this happened, I went back and looked back at the Keith Luke, where he went on this rampage in Brockton, Massachusetts in January of 2009, and he ended up killing there's a Cape Verdean community there. He ended up killing two immigrants from Cape Verde and raping and critically wounding a third. Just the similarities, Gendron, I have no interest in watching the live streams. I mean, I've seen plenty of horrible stuff in my life, and if I felt it necessary, I'd watch them. But it's been widely reported that at one point he apparently shot the store manager, who was white, and he was cowering. And as he was going around the store looking, he was killing off wounded people. He came across the store manager cowering behind a register, and Peyton Gendron is just like, "Oh, sorry." And he levels his gun at him, then apologizes and goes away without shooting. Keith Luke did the same thing. He apologized to the cops afterwards for shooting at them because they're white. And there's another case from Massachusetts last year. I forget the killer's name, but he was targeting black people, and there were white bystanders who said, he just ran right past us with his guns, didn't even point. He was going specifically for black people. So it's very explicit, even when they don't leave a manifesto, or even when before the term was invented. But to get back to the first point you made, so there've been so many of them that the first strategy was it's lone wolves, and that doesn't work anymore when you could just rattle off their names, right? Robert Bowers, Tree of Life Synagogue, John Ernest, the Poway synagogue shooter, Patrick Grugius, Dylan Roof. It's just I commit these names in memory because I'm going to rattle them off at you because you own them, right? The right has spawned all these killers. So that was the strategy for a long time. Even, someone like Nicholas Cruz, The Parkland, high school shooter where he killed 17. Now, that wasn't great replacement, but he was railing against Jews and Blacks and immigrants on social media. He was a Trump fanatic. He even put a MAGA hat on the remains of his dead mother at her funeral and took an Instagram photo. I mean, these are sick people, and they're mentally disturbed. But why is it that they're all right wing? You know, so, and you look at Reveal did a report a couple of years ago. David Neuert, who's really one of the best, longest standing writers on the extreme right wing, going back over 30 years now, right wing, far right extremism. He, up through 2019, so basically right before the start of the pandemic, they went through, I think it was over a decade of extremism. And, you know, there's Islamic extremism, religious-based terrorism in the U.S., but the majority is right-wing extremism. Mm-hmm. But they also included left-wing extremism. It's almost non-existent in comparison. And the thing about, you know, yes, you know, we can say that there's certainly Islamic extremism that exists, but the Nidal Malik, the major who shot up the army base in Texas, you actually look at their motivations, and they're very, and he's someone who basically became deeply disturbed by the Afghanistan war. They're always citing U.S. foreign policy. They're citing something real. That doesn't in no way excuse, you know, the terrorism, the killing of innocent people. But, you know, this is something that's long been predicted, you know, and it's also, that's what led to 9/11. You know, it's just like Osama bin Laden cited U.S. policy in the Middle East.
Yeah.
So in any case, with the right wing terrorism, though, this is nothing real. It's all a fabrication, and it's something that is being completely stoked by Trump, right? He like threw open the doors to anti-Semitism. You know, he used a lot of anti-Semitic memes in his campaign in 2016. Later, he was retweeting accounts that were promoters of great replacement theory. Of course, he was viciously racist. You know, and there's this whole history, you know, people coming forward, like when, you know, when he would visit the casinos, the managers would get all the Black workers off the floor. Him and his family were sued by the Justice Department. Then they entered into a decree for racist discrimination in their properties. You know, as usual, they didn't admit to any wrongdoing. You know, the Central Park Five just paying for ads calling for lynchings of these innocent youth, and to this day still claiming he did nothing wrong and they're guilty, even though they were completely exonerated. So, you know, he has basically blown open the doors to all these ideas. And fascism is very much a dynamic that it constantly needs enemies, that it came, you know, it's this idea that society is permanent warfare. You know, the whole kind of like theory about the nation and the nation state, you know, you're a nation by whom you exclude. And fascism is even more explicit in this regard. Like, you know who you are by who cannot be part of the community, who is not part of the nation, who is the, you know, the Untermensch, the subhumans who are corrupting the pure nation. And so there's this constant need to have enemies, that fascism cannot survive without enemies. So it's total warfare that will never end. That's why fascism always ends in disaster.